time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Rosalie Riegel. Rosalie Riegel is Professor Emerita in English at Saginaw Valley State University. She has been an activist for more than 45 years and has been involved with numerous peace organizations and actions. She is co-founder of the Saginaw Valley Peace Watch, is involved with the White Rose Catholic Worker, and Voices for Creative Nonviolence. She facilitates three sites with the Project for Justice, the Environment, and Peace, the Michigan Peace Network, Florida Action, and Nevada Action Network. She's on the board of the National Committee of the War Resisters League and was arrested at Creech Air Force Base for protesting military drones. And she has published two oral histories of the Catholic Worker Movement, Dorothy Day, Portraits by Those Who Knew Her, and Voices from the Catholic Worker, and is here to talk about her two latest books, Doing Time for Peace, Resistance, Family, and Community, and Crossing the Line, Nonviolent Resistors Speak Out for Peace. Rosalie, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
I'm pleased to be here, Mike. It's exciting to be in Seattle and to meet, particularly to meet the people who work with the Ground Zero Center for Creative Nonviolence, working up at Bangor at the base of the Tridents, where the Trident nuclear weapons are stored.
So talk a little bit about yourself. Tell us, how did you become involved in issues of peace?
Well, it was the Vietnam War. We were all angry. We were upset. We thought we weren't listened to. I met Dorothy Day, the co-founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, and she kept us nonviolent. Reading about nonviolence convinced me that it's only with nonviolent, particularly nonviolent direct action, that we can make lasting change. I think we need people being arrested for peace and people working in Congress for peace, and the people who are doing civil resistance speak to those who can make the change and hopefully get all of us involved in keeping the world safe.
All right. So what was the motivation for your latest two books?
Well, actually, it was because I was called to do an action that might have given me 6 months in prison. It was at Oldfoot Air Force Base, right in the heartland, the kind of command center for all the SAC, Strategic Air Command, post in Omaha, outside of Omaha, Nebraska. People were going to cross the line, and I was called to join them. That would be committing civil disobedience by trespassing onto an Air Force base and facing 6 months in prison. Well, Mike, I didn't get 6 months in prison. I got a scolding from the judge who said I was old enough to know better. But I decided I better learn better by learning what it was like for people to choose to go to commit civil disobedience and to go to prison. So as I have done for years, I listen to learn. I wrote oral histories, collected oral histories, and the result are the two books you mentioned.
All right. I want to get back to those the people in those books in just a sec. So what attracts you to oral histories?
I think we learn through stories, and my books are chock full of stories of really real people, why they did what they did, what their action was like, their trials, their imprisonment. And in doing that, I learned a lot of things, and I'm hoping the people who read my books will learn them as well. Learning from people rather than just from theory or analyses that go through other people's heads, but learning from people who've actually believed and done the work.
And to me, it seems like it's also very important to gather these histories. So many of them are being lost.
Yes, I think so. You know, I started with people who were pacifists during World War II, and I interviewed five men. Four have passed on since then. My main respondent, or one of 20 respondents in the serious action called Plowshares, Sister Ann Montgomery, died last a year ago, August. So I'm very, very pleased that I was able to get these interviews at the time I did. Oral history is a wonderful resource, and one easy to do, actually. The editing's hard, but the recording is pretty easy.
And, of course, it has a rich history with going back centuries.
Oh, yes, yes, to Homer. Storytelling. I was very influenced by Chicago Studs Terkel, who, we have had a nice relationship before he passed away.
All right, so let's talk about some of the people and their stories that are within the two volumes, your two latest volumes. And we had a recent trial of Plowshares activists.
Yes, I think I'd like to speak particularly about Plowshares actions. One, because I think the public often doesn't understand them or know about them. And two, because of this latest trial of a group of three people called the Transform Now Plowshares. But let's talk, what is Plowshares? Plowshares comes from the Isaiah verse, Old Testament, people of the book, Christians, Jewish, and Muslim all recognize the Old Testament. Isaiah chapter 2, verse 4 says, "And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more." That is a prophecy, a beacon, a directive that a group of people, Christians and Jewish people both, have taken as a modus for action, particularly against the scourge of the century, nuclear weapons, because they believe that nuclear weapons are the taproot of violence, that the cause of all the violence that is wreaked upon the world, mostly by the United States, but within countries, the violence of bombing and terrorists and people with going mayhem with guns, is rooted in the fact that we have this capacity to kill people so many thousands of times over, and that the U.S. holds most of it. I mean, Washington State, where we are today, would be the biggest nuclear state country in the world if it was not part of the United States, which arguably is the biggest. So Plowshares people take this as their basis, and they commit civil disobedience, usually just a trespass action, which goes into a base and symbolically destroys a nuclear weapon, usually by pouring blood to remind people that war causes blood. And this is the big thing that modern warfare hides and modern media hides. We don't see coffins anymore on TV, much less the bloodshed of a bomb. And they symbolically disarm a nuclear weapon, pouring blood, hammering, again, with the, as the Isaiah told us, hammering swords into plowshares. Some plowshares actions actually cause damage, particularly in Europe. They seem to be a little more successful, both in actually dismantling a warplane, as they did before the Iraq War at Shannon Airport, and in getting acquittals. Because when people do this, Mike, they are arrested, tried, and spend time in jail. Most generally, they have to look at jail terms. And the people who did the Transform Now Plowshares action in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, manufacture of the plutonium that goes into every nuclear weapon we own, they're facing a huge, huge sentence, maybe as high as 23 years. They were convicted last week of an action in the summer of 2012. And were able to get in to the inner sanctum of this nuclear installation because of security screw-ups, basically. The thing that's saddest about that, and one that is really tore at people's heart, is the fellow who finally arrested him was fired. And he knew they were nonviolent. He had been a guard at Rocky Flats, which is a Colorado facility that used to make nuclear weapons and was finally closed through a lot of action over the years. He knew they were nonviolent, and he didn't throw them down the ground and beat them up as he was supposed to. And he was fired for that. And they all feel really bad, and we're hoping that his union will get his job back.
So they are awaiting sentencing?
They're awaiting sentencing. They won't be sentenced till September. And we have learned that they will not be released pending sentence. So they are currently in jail. And, you know, I would love it, Mike, if people would write to them. Sister Megan Rice is 83. She calls herself the poster child of the Plowshares because they're always interviewing her. Wonderful woman. Greg Bocher Obed is in his 60s. I know him well. His wife actually was interviewed. They've both done several Plowshares actions from Minnesota. And Michael Wally, who has been a Catholic worker for years, was in the Army himself, speaks so prophetically for peace in the particularly in the courtroom last week. Would be lovely if they would write to them.
And I understand the people can find out more information via the website transformnowplowshares.wordpress.com.
Yes, that's correct. transformnowplowshares.wordpress.com. If you just Google Transform Now Plowshares, there's wonderful, wonderful information, transcript reports from the trials, biographical information, and the addresses. They would very much appreciate supportive letters because it's going to get lonely for them in jail. I don't think any one of them can even see each other now. They're in two separate detention facilities and will probably be transferred soon. But that website will be kept up to date, so keep it on your bookmark and write letters to Sister Megan Rice, Mike Wally, and Greg Bocher Obed.
And it seems that the government response is in threat of 23 years of prison time is more in response to the embarrassment of how far these people got in versus the few thousand of dollars of damage that they supposedly did.
I think that's particularly true for this latest one, but it's amazing in the Plowshares history, the Plowshares actions, how often people have actually had to call the arresting officers to get arrested, because the Plowshares people are not hit and run people. They do not do the action and escape. The action, the arrest, the trial, the imprisonment are all part of the action, so that they are speaking truth to power with their actions in all four evidences. So they don't run away. And on the cover of my book, Crossing the Line, are three women who did quite a damaging action by throwing computers into the lock in Scotland. They were acquitted. They also had to have their supporters sitting on the bank call the military police to arrest them. And when they arrested them, they said, "Oh, we know the Plowshares," and they made him a cup of tea. It's a very different attitude in Scotland. And they were able to use the necessity defense and the fact that nuclear weapons have been declared illegal by the World Court. We unfortunately are not able to use that in our, the judges don't allow us in their trials to use that illegality of nuclear weapons. But the World Court has said they're illegal. They're way too dangerous. They should not be on the face of the earth.
So expand on that a bit. The necessity defense is basically saying
the necessity defense is, it's actually two different things. The necessity defense says one commits a crime in order to keep a greater crime from being committed. During the Vietnam War, the Camden 28 trial, which I have documented in doing time for peace, they were able to win an acquittal with a necessity defense. They destroyed draft files. That's an exciting story. I hope people will buy the book and read about the Camden 28 story. This trial, they were able to at least get in the idea of the illegality of nuclear weapons, according to the World Court, but our courts do not recognize that.
So, was this, sticking with this one case in Knoxville for another minute, were they waiting there for hours before there was a response?
No, but they got all the way in. They walked for hours, you know, up a ridge and through these, cutting these fences that were not, they were supposed to be alarmed and they weren't. And I think actually when they, after they got in, the guard saw them right away. And, but as I said, he didn't run and tackle them. He didn't follow his procedures. It's funny because usually when they do finally come, they do these exercises of, like, you know, throwing people down on the ground and tying their hands behind their back and being, you know, really pretty rough. They're trained to do that, just as they're trained, if they're Marines particularly, to train by saying kill, kill, kill 1,000 times a day. A lot of the arrests for nonviolent protesters seem to be training actions where they arrest them violently, even though it's very obvious by their signs, by their demeanor, by their absolute lack of weapons or defense of any sort. Most of them are kneeling and praying when they're arrested. It's obvious that they're nonviolent, but they still arrest them very violently. Mm. And the fact that they didn't in this latest Plowshares is what got him into trouble and embarrassed the government so much. They closed the facility down for 2 weeks to fix their security goofs.
Now, there was a similar action that took place here
in Bangor. Right. That was actually the Plowshares before last, the Disarm Now Plowshares. One of the actors in that, says Father Steve Kelly, is at SeaTac as we speak. I'm hoping to vigil with him out there tomorrow. He violated his probation by doing an action at Vandenberg. At a base. Steve Kelly is a complete resister. He resists while he's in prison as well. I think you've had him on your show. He's mm-hmm. just a wonderful man. The Disarm Now Plowshares, again, was able to get all the way into the inside of Bangor before they were apprehended, and they all served time in jail. Two or three of them, I think, are profiled in doing time for peace. Wonderful, wonderful, long time. I mean, all these people were mature, let's say. Long-time peace resistors have been doing it for years because they believe so strongly that they must personally act on their conscience.
Now, your current two volumes on this issue, one of them focuses on the families and the support people. Can you talk about that and the importance of that role?
You know, I think that's probably the most important thing I learned from doing these interviews, is that people who do the CD, the, what you could maybe say, the glamorous things that, you know, go to prison and make these huge sacrifices, couldn't do it if they didn't have supportive families, supportive friends, supportive peace communities to take up the slack when they're away, to do the media work, to help them prepare for the trials, to write the letters and make the visits when they're in prison. We learned a lot in the Vietnam War because the Vietnam War actions were planned often very fast and didn't have that support. And as a result, marriages floundered and failed. Communities broke apart. I record those too because we need all of this history. We need to learn from our mistakes. I think some of the most exciting of my interviews are the Trident nuclear blockade in Puget Sound in 1982 when the Trident nuclear subs came. And Kim Wall talks about the difficulties of her family, of her children, doing the blockade as a mother with growing up children. We need all these stories. Families, particularly wives of husbands who do actions and vice versa, are crucial because they have to speak to the public while their spouse or partner is incarcerated, and as do the support communities. So the first book concentrates on the fact that we're all resistors together when someone does civil disobedience. There are also, and I record these in the second book, individuals, prophet priests who don't have family but who rely on us, basically, to keep them going as they speak prophetically through their actions. But the community is crucial. I think it's maybe the C word is the most important word we can remember as we work for peace.
And it sounds like a lot of these people end up, well, I don't know if a majority, but in like solitary confinement at times.
Actually, I think people do prison time differently. Often they're called to protest something that's unjust within the prison. I mean, the whole prison system is unjust, but something that's particularly unjust, and will be sent to what we call segregated housing, SHU, the SHU. But some, like Steve Kelly, carry their resistance into prison. Some decide to do easier time. To work with prisoners, because many are Catholic workers and they're used to working with the homeless. And as I think almost anyone knows, our prison system picks up people who are poor. And, you know, the poor are disproportionate, the poor and the dispossessed and the African Americans and Hispanic and other racial minorities are disproportionately among our poor and among our prison population. So a lot of them choose to stay with them to walk with the prisoners, particularly the women prisoners, women resistors, but men too, to be a presence, be a peacemaking presence within the prison so that they try not to go to solitary. Also, if you go to solitary, you're cut up from visits with your family. So some of them choose to do easy time so that they can have family visits.
So if these actions are primarily symbolic, maybe talk about what people who participate in these hope to gain, because a lot of people just don't understand that. They just, right. Like, you're just wasting our tax dollars.
Right. Well, it does cost money to incarcerate people. It's one of the fact that we're building more prisons and privatizing them is a whole other issue. And people who do time for peace often become very involved in that. But first of all, they do it because it's the right thing to do. They do it because by saying no, they're preserving our right to say no. Victor Havel, and I put this at the introduction to Crossing the Line, talks about hope, the virtue of hope. Hope is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense, regardless of how it turns out. These people feel that resisting, that saying no to the way our government works, the way our government is run, the way we spend our tax dollars on war, is worth the sacrifice of prison. It's certainly, I think, that the whole disproportionate part, way over 50% of our income tax that goes to war, the little minuscule part that's spent on feeding people in prison is palls in comparison. So they do it because they know it's the right thing to do this resistance. It's the right thing for them. But they also believe that we need people on all parts of the spectrum if we're going to stop war. We need people committing civil disobedience, and we need people who serve in Congress, and we need people to convince those in the vast middle part of us to change our electoral system and make democracy more representative. So saying no, preserving our free speech, is a very important part of their of their reason for doing it. Many are called to do it, as I think I said earlier, through a Christian faith that sees Jesus as peacemaker and realizes that both Christianity, Judaism, and Muslim, the people of the book, call for a peaceful world, not a world with war.
And there are many people that aren't religious that participate in this as well.
Yes, there are. Although the people I interviewed, probably just because they were people I knew and people that knew people I knew, many of them have a faith base. Many of them do. And I think sometimes people in the secular movement don't understand it. They don't understand this whole concept of sacrifice as building up the common good, that somehow the sacrifice of one helps move the whole cause along. And that's kind of a theological look that many of the people I spoke to did. But a lot of them speak through, like, Carl Meyer, who was has been a wonderful tax resister all his life and has spent a lot of time in jail, mostly for other kinds of things, really sees this free speech issue as paramount, that we have to speak truth to power with our actions, even if we don't see any immediate result from a particular action. It all goes into the whole.
And are the people who are to participate in these actions, are they fully cognizant of the potential reactions from the powers that be, that you're walking into a very high-end military base where they will use force and shoot you dead if you do the wrong thing?
Yes, they are. You know, one of the things that I think is really good about the Plaszczuk action, and again, something they learned through the Vietnam War, through the draft board actions in the Vietnam War, is preparation, research and community building within the group that does the action, and psychological preparation. There have been people, and their interviews I recorded in the book, who people have said, nah, you just aren't ready for a Plowshares action. You don't have the right motivation. You're basically not psychologically together. There have been people who have done Plowshares actions in the past who were too young, who just didn't have the maturity to be able to face a jail sentence. So they're very, very careful in their discernment and preparation and making sure that people are ready, that they know the consequences, and that they take appropriate precautions. That's why the, for instance, kneeling down if they're in a deadly force zone, having banners which are prominently displayed so that those who are coming to arrest them will see right away that they're nonviolent activists. Katja Karmasurik, a wonderful woman, she's a lawyer actually now in Santa Cruz, had flowers and wore a very pretty dress for her Plowshares action so that people would know that that she was nonviolent, you know, so she was dressed appropriately. She actually was not arrested. She came in, trashed a computer, and went out and turned herself in the next morning in San Francisco. But she was very careful not to expose herself to violence or to cause violence. And so there's never been an injury in a Plowshares action. There have been people fell and sprained their ankle and things like that, but never an injury from the armed forces.
All right. Well, we are just about out of time. We're talking with Rosalie Riegel. She is author of the two new books, Doing Time for Peace, Resistance, Family, and Community, and Crossing the Line, Nonviolent Resistors Speak Out for Peace.
I want to say that they're both available at Elliott Bay Bookshop and also online, and that I will be in San Francisco all next week speaking four different places in the San Francisco area, because I love to answer questions about the book.
All right. And people can find out more about the current trial with the Plowshares, the Transform Now Plowshares, via their website, transformnowplowshares.wordpress.com.
Yes.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Well, I love being here, Mike. Thank you.